Welcome to Out of Bounds. I'm Tish Pearlman. My guest is poet Michael Jennings. Jennings was born in New Orleans and grew up in East Texas and the deserts of southwestern Iran. He is a graduate of both the University of Pennsylvania and Syracuse University. He has published 9 collections of poetry. His most recent is a very beautiful and personal chapbook called River Time. It was published by Wells College Press after awarding Jennings first prize in their 2014 chapbook competition. And welcome back to the show.
Thank you much.
Now, as I mentioned in the intro, you grew up in East Texas and in Iraq. Tell us about these landscapes and how they came into this book in such a clear fashion.
Well, the story of this book is that I have a very old poet friend. I mean, we've known each other for years, who had been harassing me to write poems about Texas for years. And I said, well, I left Texas when I was very young, and I don't think I know enough. But I had a sort of blank in muse visitations, and so I thought, okay, let me think back. And of course, what I realized as I started them is that child mind is kind of myth mind.
Mm.
So the few things that I kind of conjured up are sort of from the child's experience, though the perspective is, I think, a little more complicated than that.
Mm-hmm. Oh, absolutely it is. I know this is a book in full, but did you set out to write an autobiographical collection like this when you began?
Well, I've always sort of written autobiographically. This just took me back almost to the beginning. Often I had sort of started the story in Iran, which is where I ended up after leaving East Texas.
Mm.
So this sort of went back earlier.
Did you ever find a conflict in your head about when you're writing about a real place and real experiences, how much to reveal? Does that ever come up for you as a poet?
Not much. I think the art of any art is knowing what to leave out. And that's what you kind of can't teach.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's important to leave things out to sort of invite the reader in with his or her own experience to sort of process this particular experience. But I don't worry really about exposing too much because, you know, you sort of create these poems to not be haunted by the recollection. And as soon as you have a place to put it, then it's, you know, it's out there.
Yeah, it is a way to exercise,
right.
In some ways, experiences that maybe are somewhat painful or just nostalgic.
I
understand that, yeah. Now, let's have you read a poem from Rivertime. This one's called Alma's House. Do you want to tell us a little about it before you read it?
Well, this is about a woman who was very appropriately named Alma, meaning soul or spirit or love, depending on your language. And this was the first experience I thought back on when I was trying to find places that sort of reverberated with the sense of place and the time, a sort of. So this is called Alma's House. I keep seeing this muddy, sometimes sun-baked road from Alma's crooked porch on the Negro side of Beaumont, Texas, circa 1955. It's where I stayed when my parents were away, a world of tumble-down shacks and angry young men that Alma kept at bay whenever I was out there. Except for Nick, Alma's husband, who sometimes mowed our lawn, I knew only the women who took me to church in their big white dresses and enormous hats and sang hymns as if they meant them. Nick called me honey and stroked my hair. He was the color of dried tobacco leaves and seemed older and more tired than any man I'd ever known, but also kinder. Maybe he'd once been a great hellraiser, a razor in his pocket and a bottle in a bag, like men I later met on trains, trading swigs and stories and a sense of death hurtling at us out of the night sky. But there was no devil in Nick in my day, only a kind of fatherly Job. They fed me mustard greens and collard greens and okra, dark aromas that made their house exotic with its tilting floors and peeling linoleum, and let me sleep in their bed and play with Alma's nearly blind little black retriever and Nick's skinny, flea-bitten hound chained to his house out back. They taught me to stay out of the way of the gargantuan geese, the real watchdogs, and to feed the chickens, and visit Ida, the coffee-colored hairdresser next door, who do all the neighborhood ladies in her big hardwood living room while everybody laughed and Alma smoked cigarettes, which I'd never seen before. But I never went down that rutted dirt road beyond Alma's house that seemed to go nowhere but into weeds and more collapsing shacks and maybe some swampland nobody wanted. When she died, I was a freshman in college, and Nick wrote asking for money. I sent him $10, half my week's allowance. Sorry, I wrote. Sorry.
God, that's beautiful. That's such a beautiful... You know, I can feel the sepia tone passed in the dust.
Okay.
Was that a hard thing to write, to conjure up some of that? Because it seems so visceral, you know?
Well... You know, it was an experience that I must have gone back to in the sort of revisions of memory, consciously or unconsciously. But it took a certain amount of concentration for me to bring what seemed to me the kind of relevant details together, but... I just kept moving it down the page, and the details kind of kept coming.
Yeah, it almost feels like your ghost traveled back to the past. I love that piece. Now, you said in some material that you sent me that while growing up in the deserts of Iran, that you first felt the ache of history. To tell me about that, because this book has that all through it.
Well, when I lived in Iran, the day-to-day life of local people... was essentially biblical. You know, they lived in mud huts. They threshed their wheat with donkeys. It was like stepping back in time. And then you go and you see the ruins of the great empire, and there's not too much topsoil left there. So you have a sense of sort of oceans of stone or oceans of sand, and the sort of coming and going of conquerors and the conquered. You know, I could go out my back door and come to Roman roads and things, and then, of course, things much, much older than that. So you see the difficulty of life at the local level, where at that time a dollar a day was a lot of money. Most kids don't live to be 5 years old. So it also gives you a sense that you're pretty lucky to be alive.
Mm-hmm.
But it also gave me a sense of how things are sort of cycles through history, the rising and falling of oceans of time and mm-hmm. empires.
And so much of history seems sad.
Oh, yeah.
Because loss.
It's so violent.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now, what your poetry also captures for me is that yearning for a place called home and looking for a place called home and trying to describe it, and yet even when you find it, you're still looking for a connection somehow.
Well, I think I took up poems in some ways to have a home. I never lived any place more than 2 years until I went to boarding school. So I think I had... a hankering for some place to call home, and poems sort of became it. You know, I could resurrect the Iranian landscape of my youth and so on. But I think with most people who have lived as I have, I know a number of friends, and we all agree that we can be equally un-at home anywhere.
That's an interesting observation. Yeah. I want to have you read two short poems from the collection, and they're sort of related to each other. One's called Black Elk, the other's called Ceremony. Do you want to say anything about them before you read them?
Well, as I drifted out of East Texas imaginatively, I wanted to touch on little pieces of Western myth and legend. And black elk was one of the first that kind of came into vision. I got interested in trying to write quite small poems in the middle of the book. I remembered the tradition of poems on buses, which I wasn't much interested in. But as a storyteller, I thought it would be interesting to see how small I can make what are essentially pretty big stories.
Mm.
So Black Elk was one of the first attempts at that. Black Elk once rode into battle with only a ceremonial bow thrust out before him, so he became an arrowing thunder god, and the blue coats ran. Crazy Horse was scarier still, a phantom fire, unkillable. But the mountains failed them, and the grasses failed them, and the rivers. So much spirit eradicated in 50 years. So much sorrow. So little space to be alone with the alone. So little time to walk in the sun.
That's beautiful.
And that was sort of the way Black Elk Speaks made me feel, that nostalgia for all that space and all that spirit, mm-hmm. all that magic that mm-hmm. got driven out. And ceremony is literally what happened on a November night in 2012. Oscar Wilde was in America when Jesse James was killed, and he said, "Americans are great hero worshipers, and they always take them from the criminal classes."
Mm.
And I heard a philosopher once say, "Western thought is a braid of Hebrew and Greek. From the Hebrew, the hero is Job, obedience, and in the Greek, it's Prometheus, the outlaw." So those two things figure in at least one of these phrases. Ceremony. Tonight, black skeletons of maples against a November sky is all I know of heaven and all I hope to know. Russell Means is dead. Geronimo is dead. Crazy Horse is dead. And in the land of the sacred outlaw, Obama has taken the White House. Viva Zapata and his white horse. Viva the snake-eyed killers of lies and those who stand in line. Tonight, under the long ache of distance and far stars, I celebrate ghosts whose moccasined souls listen to earth, the great mystery of trees, coyotes yelping on a black hill. And I think that's the only overtly political poem I've ever written.
Yeah, I was going to say, both those poems feel like history coming full circle in some ways.
Right,
and in regard to your vision
right.
and your experiences. Yeah, I absolutely thought those poems should be read together. Now, tell us a little bit about what your habits are as a writer. Are you deliberately saying, "I'm going to write 2 hours a day"? Do you
wait
till the spirit moves you? How do you do it?
I completely depend on the muse. Though I try to make myself available as often as possible, I have a front deck where I sit and kind of meditate and see where my imagination might go. But I don't write all that frequently. When the ideas are going, I go with it, and when they're not, I wait and hope they'll come again.
If you're just joining us, my guest is poet Michael Jennings. We're talking about his new chapbook of poetry called River Time. Now, your poetry is a lot less abstract than some of the poets that I've talked to. You seem to set out to tell real stories. Is that a hard thing for you to convene? Does it take a lot of rewriting and shaping and actually even research?
Well, occasionally it takes research. I'm not a great researcher, but for some of these poems, I did read a couple of books to kind of, you know, sometimes you read a whole book just to get one detail, one image
mm-hmm.
that kind of seems to speak for something.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm interested in sort of luring the unconscious, but I sort of believe in the story as the thing that is the most human magic.
And it's this thing that connects us as well.
Exactly. Yeah, yeah. And in the South, they have such, you know, great traditions of beating around the bush as long as possible. And I think of these poems as sort of Southern storytelling with a little less beating around the bush.
And I can understand doing research, too, because, I mean, that's a way to sort of dip into the atmosphere that you're looking for, perhaps.
Right.
Yeah, yeah. Now, another more personal memory of Texas seems to be the next poem that I want you to read, called Dancing at the Silver Dollar. Tell us a little bit about that one.
Well, we used to go on vacation to a town called Bandera, Texas, which is a town that's fed by dude ranches. And I was taken along to the Silver Dollar, which is where people went dancing on Saturday nights. And when I was thinking back, trying to pinpoint a sort of quintessentially Texas experience, this old barn of a place came to mind. Mm. Let's see if I can. So it is called Dancing at the Silver Dollar. By day it was a big, dreary barn of a place, but at night it was lit up like stars on the prairie. The only hot spot in Bandera, a town fed by dude ranches and tourist trade, with old west storefronts and wooden sidewalks, just like the movies. Stores that sold boots and Stetsons and moccasins, all the attire of weekend cowboys and cowgirls who flocked on Saturday nights to the dance hall called the Silver Dollar, where the steel guitar sent shivers up your spine like a breeze in the live oaks, and the women twirled and the men sashayed, and the sheriff moseyed in with a .38 riding like a small boat on the fleshy sea of his right hip, as I worked up the nerve to ask the girl to dance with an outbreak of psoriasis on her right hand. My father said I shouldn't mention, and didn't. She was 7 and I was 8. The full extent of our conversation as we circled the room, doing the two-step, cute as proverbial buttons, with a whisper of moccasins and the stomping of boots, not quite heaven, but close as I'd ever come to the leathery heart of Texas.
I love that. God, I can just see you kids dancing. That's a wonderful piece. And it's strangely cheerful
in many ways. For my poems, it's pretty cheerful.
Now, a huge aspect of being a poet is the spoken word. Did it take you a long time to find your performance voice? You read so well. You sound like a storyteller instead of somebody just reading a line.
I was dyslexic, and when I was in high school and was asked to read out loud, I would stammer and stutter and whatever. And I realized that it's because my eye moves more easily right to left than left to right. So I would lift words from below the line and put them in.
Wow.
And when I came to poetry, I realized two things. One is, as compensation for being dyslexic, I had been given a great oral recall. If I heard kids quiz each other, I never forgot anything I heard. So when I decided to write poems, I just learned lots and lots of poems by heart. And then I also taught myself to kind of relax my mind enough to read out loud. But I often, in readings, traditionally, I've always recited poems. I do it a little less now because I'm older, and I don't trust my memory quite as much. But the poems, I feel my way through the poems as sound.
Mm-hmm. So, and it feels more like theater than just a poetry reading. I love that because it's rare to hear a poet read that way.
Right. Well, it's just the voice that I compose the poems to, basically.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, I understand
that. I kind of work them out in my ear.
Yeah, that makes sense to me. How much importance do you place on placing individual poems into literary journals? And is that a real way to build a career?
I think it's very wise if you're an aspiring poet. I've never done it much. I do it sporadically. I never like my poems when I see them in magazines. They seem kind of stiff. They don't. I'm much more interested in collections of poems and how they can talk to each other. But I do sort of dutifully send poems in the mail and try to, you know, just so that when I write to the next editor, I can say they've been published here, here, and
yeah,
here.
Yeah.
But it's never been a terribly important thing for me because I've always loved books of poems.
Mm-hmm. I understand that. Yeah, but books do speak in a different voice.
Absolutely. I've always thought that the worst thing we do to poetry in the schools is the anthology. You know, they're so sort of sterile and anemic.
You know, the
single poem by this poet, you move on to the next
poem.
Yeah,
and it's fragmentation of people's vision in many ways. I agree with you on that. Now, we have one final poem that I want you to read from River Time, and this is the title poem. And this is a love poem. And you don't write too many of those. This is a very, very beautiful love poem. Do you want to tell us about it before you read it?
Well, I wrote this for our 30th anniversary, and I believe you were at the party. And it's a poem that came in bits and pieces. Its concept, I guess, arises from Heraclitus's comment that we never step in the same river twice. And metaphorically, we're sort of rivers. So when I named it River Time, I also had in mind sort of the river of time and so on. But it was written for my wife, River Time. The hills are green with summer. The lakes cobalt blue and glittering. Whatever we longed for in March is here already or forgotten. Your hair gleaming obsidian as always, despite a few white renegades. Your body stretches out like a great cat's or a landscape I never tire of crossing. When I kiss the small of your back, I hear the whisper of desert sands, the rush of young rivers. No one comes back. No one steps twice in the same body. Spring was sun on the daffodils and the time of the new wide sky, the heartbreaking golds of the giant willows. Marry me, marry me, shouted the cardinal in his tall tree, while the goldfinch giggled, I am nothing but light.
Yeah, that's beautiful. Did your wife like it as well?
Yes.
I love that line, no one steps twice in the same body. That's a beautiful, very beautiful
it's,
line.
It's,
yeah.
You know, it's the variation of the Heraclitus, you know, metaphor. And I have a Hungarian friend who didn't get it at all because he wasn't familiar with that phrase. But it's pretty common, I think, in usage about the river, but it occurred to me that it's the same with the body.
Yeah, that's a beautiful poem. How was your experience winning this contest? Have you won many contests? I know you won this contest. That's why this book was published.
Well, I won contests when I was an undergraduate, and since then I've hardly ever entered a contest. I had written these poems. I was pleased with them. They seemed to do something different than I had done before. And I just heard by coincidence that there was this contest that was focused on poems of place. That was sort of its theme. And I thought, well, these are definitely poems of place.
Mm-hmm.
All my poems tend to be poems of place, but in this case, I think it's because I sort of believe in the Jungian concept that the soul is likely more out there than in here, that I think we know ourselves by our landscapes. That's children, whatever the landscape of their childhood tends to remain kind of a magical kingdom in their imagination, I think, even if it's just a little block of woods or something, vacant lot or whatever.
And so you think we carry that landscape with us and it becomes our soul in some way?
Well, Snodgrass once had a line in a poem, we need the landscape to repeat us. And I think he was talking about an echo, but I think in a way we do need the landscape to repeat us and reinforce. You know, people who have fantasies of going into outer space and living among plastic, I think are crazy. I think the human psyche really needs grass and trees and things to know itself. I think if you divorce us from Earth, we probably go crazy.
Well, we don't know if those planets don't have grass and water and birds.
If you can travel far enough, yes.
Yeah, that I understand what you mean. Well, what do you say to aspiring young poets? What is the experience that you've learned that has helped you through this career and to keep going?
Well, it's kind of a push-pull thing. On the one hand, a poet has got to have enough arrogance to believe in himself or herself to get the work made despite the kind of criticism that you may get and so on. On the other hand, you have to always be open to learning from people who know more and so on. So it's sort of a balancing act of separating the wheat from the chaff as far as the advice that you're given, and I think it's sort of, you know, Sylvia Plath said, you know, creating the artist is the most important thing that the artist does, but she also said an artist is someone who, looking down and finding his tie and his soup, continues eating as if he intended his tie to be in his soup.
Right.
You know, so you're stuck with who you are, but how you deal with it is what makes the art.
Yeah, yeah. We only have a couple minutes left. Are you working on any new stuff? Any new books coming?
No. Oh. I've been packaging a couple of sort of selected poems. But when I finished this, I felt like I had finished something. And if other poems are going to come, I think they're going to come from other places.
Mm-hmm. Are you giving any readings with this book in the coming months?
I have been giving some. I have read it, Wells and Huca.
And any coming up in the future?
I at the end of the month, I think I'm doing a brief reading in downtown Syracuse at the Point of Contact. But that's actually because of Stone Canoe. I had a poem there, and one of these poems, actually. And so I think I'm there to read that poem. And beyond that, I can't remember.
We can have people contact you through your website.
Absolutely.
Right? Can you give the website?
Yeah, you can. It's MichaelJenningsPoetry.com, all one word.
And they can get in touch with you there. And there must be a few of these books available.
Oh, yes, there's still a few.
Great. Well, Michael Jennings, thank you so much for joining us. Again, the new collection is called River Time.
Thank you. It was my pleasure. Thanks.
Our audio producer is Nate Richardson at Rep Studio in Ithaca, New York. Our theme music was composed by Diego Vega. And we are a sponsored project of the New York Foundation for the Arts. Tax-deductible donations are welcome at artspire.org. That's artspire.org. And visit us online at outoboundsradioshow.com. I'm Tish Perlman. We'll be back next week.